I will remind you that now we have an audio recording system, and so your arguments will be recorded. You'll be able to go back after the fact and pull the recordings from our website. So with that in mind, I have to give a little bit better announcement than we used to do. Court will call Mometrics Media versus LCR Publishing, cause number 1700570CV. For those of you new to the third court, you have 20 minutes to argue. Generally, you can save 5 minutes back for rebuttal as the appellant, and I assume that you've talked to our timekeeper to settle how you want to do that. We have a time warning system. When the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes. When the red light comes on, you have run out of time and you need to look back to the court to continue. By way of housekeeping, if our one or two audience members have a cell phone, pager, other device that might go off, if you would turn that off at this point in time. And with that, we are ready to hear from the attorneys.
May it please the court, Joe Sibley on behalf of the appellant Mometrics Media. At tab 2A1 of our appendix, the basis for the plaintiff's claim against Mometrics is found. And just looking at that piece of correspondence, it's a piece of correspondence addressed to copyright agent, CreateSpace Legal Department. It states the following product, published by CreateSpace, infringes upon copyright content. And in the plaintiff's petition, the plaintiffs define CreateSpace as Amazon's independent online publisher. And the complaint is in regards to the removal of the plaintiff's products from the Amazon marketplace. In that piece of correspondence to the copyright agent from Mometrics, the products identified, there's a web address given, and it's an Amazon domain. So there's a complaint to the copyright agent at CreateSpace, Amazon's online publisher, about content listed on Amazon. And it goes on to say, at the end, I have a good faith belief that the disputed use is not authorized by the copyright owner. I am the copyright owner or authorized to act on the copyright owner's behalf. Well, if we look at 17 U.S.C. 512, subsection C3, it has what the elements of a DMCA takedown notice are. And by the way, nowhere in what we refer to as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act or the DMCA does it refer to itself as the DMCA. And if you look at the elements of notification, basically has everything that we have in our notice. It doesn't say you have to cite the chapter and verse of the federal code. It doesn't say you have to say this is a takedown notice under the DMCA. It just says you have to have the address of who's complaining, the content that you're complaining about, et cetera. And that's exactly what is in the letter that they're complaining about. So,
did you have a burden, though, to raise the DMCA before the trial court? Or can you raise that for the first time here? And if so, whose burden of proof is it to establish what?
Your Honor,
exclusive jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I think the federal case law clearly holds that. I mean, we all know that copyright laws within the exclusive domain of federal courts. And so under Texas law, and I think pretty much anyone's law, subject matter jurisdiction, especially where there's exclusive federal jurisdiction, can be raised even by the court sua sponte. I mean, if we were in here litigating over a patent in state court, the court could just sua sponte realize that this is within the exclusive jurisdiction of a federal court.
But whose burden is it to establish that this case is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court? And can this body actually do that? Is there any fact determinations that we would be required to make in order to make that determination? Or does this case get remanded back to the trial court for that?
Your Honor, I think if the record was unclear about whether this was falling within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts, then I would agree that the court probably would not have. I mean, obviously, it would have to be obvious from the pleadings, from the record, that the court that what we were dealing with here was a federal copyright claim. I don't know that there's really a burden of proof here, Your Honor, as it is by looking at the plain, you know, when we remove a case to federal court, for example, the federal court is going to look at the plaintiff's pleadings. What have you complained about? And even if the plaintiff has pleaded a complaint or a petition in our court, which says, I am complaining about the defendant's illegal copying of my material. They don't use the copyright chapter and verse. They don't say Copyright Act. That is clearly still within the exclusive jurisdiction of federal court. So,
but there's a line of cases that talk about whether, about making that determination of whether something falls under the act, the federal act. You know, does it have an additional element? Is there something else that has to be proven, or was there something else proven to take it out of the exclusive general exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts?
No, Your Honor. I would point the court to the Amaretto Ranch Breedables case. It's at 2011 U.S. District Court, Lexus 73853. That case actually distinguishes the Rock River case that they've cited in their reply brief, I'm sorry, their surreply brief. And what it says is, a takedown notification is a creature of federal statutory regime, and any claim based on a DMCA takedown notice is preempted. So the question before the court is, based on what they've attached to their petition, comparing that to what the federal statute describes as a DMCA takedown notice, kind of the same way that if they had pleaded a sort of cryptic copyright infringement complaint, the court would look at what the federal statute or copyright code says about what falls within the ambit of the copyright code and determine whether that's within exclusive federal jurisdiction or not. And I think...
So we don't have to engage in that analysis of whether or not tortious interference has an additional element that an infringement of a Copyright Act case would have, and we don't have to worry about the difference between the damages that would be available for tortious interference versus what damages are available under the Section 512.
I think under the federal case law, the answer is no, Your Honor, because what the federal courts have stated is that it would frustrate the federal purpose and it would violate the Supremacy Clause if state courts were providing remedies for what the federal copyright scheme has provided a remedy for. And there is a remedy. They have the opportunity to go back to Amazon, to go back to CreateSpace and say, hey, we have a right to this material.
But there's they're no the ones that are claiming that were originally claiming ownership, and they have to go and claim their own ownership of that product in federal
court?
Yes,
that would be under the, well, what they would have to do that with the service provider. They would go to the service provider and say, hey, here's our proof that we own this material, or we have the right to use it. And then if the service provider doesn't put it back up, they might have some remedy against the service provider. There's no evidence that ever occurred, by the way, but if, as they claim, we did this in bad faith, we didn't really have the right to use it, that's all provided for under Section 512. There are remedies and causes of action that you can bring under Section 512 to address that. So
I'm understanding now that you're saying that simply by attaching the notice, that was enough to take it into federal law, and that it should have been, the trial court should have recognized that at that point in time.
Well, I don't know that the trial court necessarily should have recognized it. We probably should have addressed this with the trial court at that point. We felt like that there was, I mean, basically they admitted that their material was infringing copyright. So we kind of felt like that should be enough to get us out of the case under the TCPA. After we looked at this a little more closely, based on some of the allegations they made, for example, that we were, quote unquote, the improper DMCA agent. That's one of the claims that they made. So when we looked at this a little further, we realized that there's some case law that's been developing which says, look, if you're complaining about a takedown notice that falls within the purview of the DMCA, that has these elements, that's the test. Does it have the elements of a DMCA takedown notice?
On that front, though, and forgive my ignorance of federal copyright law, who does a takedown notice have to be directed to, and sort of what are the parameters that make this a takedown notice?
The copyright agent, Your Honor. It has to be there's a list of copyright agents so that people, the way the DMCA works generally is that, you know, places like Amazon, eBay, you know, that's user content. I mean, they're selling user content. People put a particular product on their site. They're basically an online marketplace. So what the DMCA was designed to do was to protect these online marketplaces from sort of being complicit in infringement if they have a designated agent to receive complaints about infringing material, and then they promptly take it down and give the party whose product was taken down the right to demonstrate that they have ownership, et cetera. There's a scheme that's in that code.
And is that all that happened here? Is there more to it? It takes it over to the realm of tortious interference.
No, Your Honor, because if the complaint, their entire complaint is based on our correspondence to the copyright agent. It's addressed to the copyright agent at CreateSpace. States that you're publishing infringing material. It has all of the elements that's listed under Section 512 to constitute a DMCA takedown notice.
And I don't do federal copyright law here, so.
Because they're telling us we can.
Right. DMCA provide for a damages as against you for an improper takedown notice? Or is it only against CreateSpace and Amazon? Because in my initial reading of this act, I thought it was all what providing some relief for providers who kind of post that information, like CreateSpace and Amazon, but that you can't get to the person who posted the takedown notice. Am I mistaken in that assumption?
No, you can, Your Honor. It's under subsection F.
Yeah.
It's section 512F. It says misrepresentations, because obviously Congress understood that there was an opportunity for abuse here. People could just attack their competitors by making frivolous claims. So what it says is any person who knowingly materially misrepresents under this section that the material or activity is infringing, or that material or activity was removed or disabled by mistake or misidentification, shall be liable for any damages, including costs and attorney's fees. So there's a whole, and basically if you look at that, it essentially mirrors our tortious interference law in the sense that
there's no exemplary damages.
I don't believe there's exemplary damages provided for. So that would be an issue of preemption. I mean, basically what the federal code is saying is, look, we've got, you know, we want to regulate this. We don't want people to be afraid to, you know, make a claim on their intellectual property. And as long as they've done so with a good faith belief, which by the way kind of mirrors our tortious interference law, right? Because it's an affirmative defense to say, look, even if I was wrong about this, I had a good faith belief that I had the right to enforce it, or it was my property. So basically, it's just kind of subsumed state tortious interference law in a federal cause of action that's under this section. So,
well, that was why my original question was about the damages.
I understand, Your Honor. Yeah, I think the federal remedy, is exclusive, and I think if you're making a claim, kind of like copyright, I mean, we know that there are unfair competition claims that people try to creatively bring, which are really repackaged copyright claims. And time after time, the courts say this is preempted. Look, you got to bring it under the copyright code, because otherwise people will circumvent copyright law and come up with creative state law torts. And that's kind of what's been developing here with these tortious interference claims under the DMCA. So I don't think there's any question that these are preempted. It ought to be dismissed on subject matter jurisdiction grounds. We did cite some authority in our reply brief, Your Honor, that preemption is actually a defense. And so I think the more interesting question is, if you have a situation where there is a lawsuit that falls within the TCPA, it's based on a communication that falls within that statutory framework, which I think this one clearly does because it's a product in the marketplace. Does the TCPA apply, and are sanctions and attorney's fees, et cetera, available when the court winds up dismissing it on a jurisdictional ground? And I think the answer has to be yes, because otherwise you could bring any claim that you wanted to. Let's say, for example, that I wanted to retaliate against someone for you know, who knows what. And I brought a claim that is not cognizable under Texas law. For example, tortious interference with inheritance, or one of these claims that our Supreme Court has recently stated is not a viable cause of action. And that claim is based on conduct that would otherwise fall under the TCPA. Should I be able to bring that lawsuit and...
But aren't we talking about two different things there? I mean, if it's not cognizable under Texas law, that doesn't mean we don't have jurisdiction, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if you're saying that we don't have subject matter jurisdiction, how do we have subject matter jurisdiction over to enforce the TCPA?
Because the court always has jurisdiction to impose sanctions, Your Honor. If I bring a claim, a frivolous claim, and make misrepresentations in state court, even if it's on a patent claim that doesn't belong.
But wouldn't we be interpreting a substantive state law statute by saying the TCPA applies?
No, because whether the TCPA applies is without regard to jurisdiction. For example, imagine if there was a personal jurisdiction issue. Imagine that you were sued in Texas and there was clearly no personal jurisdiction. The court would not have personal jurisdiction over that person, but the court would still have jurisdiction over the party who filed the lawsuit to sanction them for filing a suit that fell within the purview of the TCPA. Now, the court wouldn't get to the merits of the claim, but if there was a dismissal based on a defense, which would be jurisdiction, or in this case, I actually think there's a better argument here, because jurisdiction isn't really, I mean, it's a defense, but it's not really a defense on the merits or even going to the merits of the claim. This is a preemption defense. What we're saying is it would be like a Rule 91A claim. If we had made a Rule 91A motion on this instead of a TCPA, I think the court would have to dismiss it and award us our attorney's fees, because this is not a claim that's cognizable in Texas court.
Well, the trial court didn't award attorney's fees, so what you're saying is we have to dismiss your dismiss the case because it's preempted under federal law. Once the trial court takes up the question of attorney's fees and sanctions under TCPA.
I'm not sure I understand Her Honor's.
Well, we can't, the trial court didn't award any attorney's, I'm assuming you're asking for your attorney's fees under TCPA, yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. How do we get to that? We don't do that here. We send those back to the trial court. How do we send that back to the trial court while also dismissing the case because it's federally, it's preempted under by federal law?
Because the trial court has continuing jurisdiction to impose any sanctions or any further proceedings. I mean, this happens often with the TCPA. If a party loses at the trial court on their TCPA motion, obviously they don't get their attorney's fees at that point. If it's reversed on appeal, the court would remand to the trial court for further proceedings.
But not for lack of jurisdiction.
Well, it depends. I mean, it could be for lack of jurisdiction. It could be for lack of evidence. I mean, there's different ways the court might dismiss the case. I guess my point is that what the TCPA says is if it's a legal action that falls within the framework, the TCPA applies. And if the TCPA applies, it applies, irrespective of whether the court has subject matter jurisdiction to adjudicate the substantive claim. The court still has jurisdiction to impose sanctions, to award attorney's fees for having brought a legal action that is based on the exercise of the right of free speech, petition, association, what have you. So, and in fact, I think, I'd have to find the citation, Your Honor, but I believe there was a case, I believe there has been a case where it was dismissed on personal jurisdiction grounds and the court still awarded TCPA attorney's fees and sanctions. I'll have to double check that, but I don't think you get an out from bringing a suit that falls under the TCPA because you brought it in the wrong court or because you brought it in Texas when maybe it should have been brought in Louisiana or some other state. I don't think the TCPA gives any exemptions for jurisdictional grounds. I think if the case is dismissed and it falls under the TCPA, then the movement under the TCPA should be entitled to their attorney's fees, because the purpose of the TCPA is to prevent lawsuits based on various forms of public participation.
Ms. Sibley, if we're going beyond the question, we probably need to wrap it up and go ahead and wait for your rebuttal. You've been out of time for quite a while.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Saba.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm John Saba on behalf of Appellee LCR Publishing, LLC. This is my first appellate oral argument, so if you would kindly bear with me. There are two issues before the court today. Whether the district court correctly held that appellant's complaint letters constituted commercial speech and therefore exempt from the TCPA. And secondly, in the alternative, whether LCR met its burden under the TCPA by advancing clear and specific evidence of a prima facie case for its tortious interference claim. I need to address some underlying facts in order to discuss these issues because this is kind of a convoluted factual case. Then I'm going to address Mr. Sibley's preemption argument, talk about commercial speech, and in the alternative that LCR did meet its prima facie burden to establish its claim.
Just for the record, having pulled the trial court's order, I can't, the trial court didn't specifically find that it bought off on the commercial speech exception. It's not clear from the order whether it was the commercial speech aspect or whether they felt they met the prima facie case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so we would argue that both, under either avenue, the order should be affirmed. A brief synopsis of the facts. LCR Publishing is a Texas company that creates and publishes test prep materials. So is Mometrics, the competitor. LCR offers its materials through Amazon via its Amazon's print-on-demand subsidiary, CreateSpace. In 2015-16 timeframe, LCR began to notice a smattering of negative one-star reviews about its publications on Amazon and started doing some investigations. The reviews looked very similar in nature. It comes to light that someone was paying third parties or persons to post these negative reviews about LCR's publications on Amazon. While all of this is going on, in March of 2016, suddenly LCR's publications were suspended from CreateSpace in full. And I think they had approximately 20 books online at issue with the Mometrics complaint letters. They only targeted four. So Mometrics' four complaint letters ultimately completely dismantled LCR's entire online presence.
And are they takedown notices?
Your Honor, our position is that they do not comply with the provisions of 512, 17 U.S.C. 512, but the bigger issue is that in Rock River, the DMCA doesn't apply to a CreateSpace type of content provider, and therefore there's no preemption, and I'm happy to talk about that now or later. So
you might want to do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me switch gears for a second. Oh, I do want to say one thing really quick, because I think this is probably the most confusing fact. LCR files a lawsuit against John Doe for the false claims and then against Mometrics for tortious interference. And in the TCPA motion that Mometrics filed, they explained what they did. And what they did was they rifled through LCR's publications and found two pages that looked similar to third-party content.
Right.
Then try to go to third parties and say, hey, we want to buy your content. Also, they could send a complaint letter to CreateSpace, which effectuated a complete suspension of the book. So it's convoluted in that regard. I want to talk about the DMCA and preemption. This is not a copyright infringement case. The claims in this lawsuit concern Mometrics' tortious interference actions and their false representations they made in dismantling our books. Mometrics never owned the content that belies its representations. And even though Mometrics claims it did somehow own the content, that doesn't magically transform this lawsuit into a copyright matter. Specifically with regard to the DMCA, and I'm going to rely on Mr. Sibley's oral argument exhibit because I think that might be helpful. In its reply brief for the first time, appellant attempts to raise the new argument that the DMCA somehow preempts LCR's tortious interference claims. Mr. Sibley spent some time discussing the adequacy of the complaint letters that Mometrics sent regarding four of the books. But the Rock River case addresses the bigger issue, and that the DMCA does not apply to all online content providers. And the issue in Rock River, I think it's a little easier if I explain the facts, if it pleases the court. Rock River versus Universal Music Group, Central District of California, 2011. The court held that plaintiff's tortious interference claims was not preempted by the DMCA, and the analysis was as follows. And I told you I'd tell you about the facts, and I didn't. But Rock River remixed and created a version of some Bob Marley songs, posted it on iTunes, or not posted it, but this content, music content, was offered through iTunes. Universal Music Group, which is an enormous label, said, hey, we own Bob Marley rights, sent a letter to iTunes saying, hey, take this down, we have exclusive rights. Rock River sued Universal for tortious interference. And Universal raises a preemption argument that, well, look, all of this is covered by the DMCA. The Central District for California said no. And the reason is because under 512C of the DMCA, 512C applies to what I will call, for sake of argument, passive internet providers, not active content providers. Passive in the sense that anyone can go to YouTube and post content, and YouTube has no idea until someone alerts them that there's a problem. They don't care. They don't vet the content. They're just there to host. Same with Facebook. Same with Instagram. These are true passive internet service providers that the DMCA applies to. In the case of iTunes, it's not, because what iTunes does is has discretion in providing its content. And because iTunes is active in vetting the content, it's not afforded the rights under the DMCA. And if the DMCA doesn't apply to iTunes, then the notice provisions of the takedown notice procedure in 512C13 does not apply, regardless of whether or not you do it right. So even if you say I met every subheading of the notice provisions, the court says it doesn't matter because the DMCA is intended for, like I said, passive internet service providers.
Then why the notice addressed to copyright agent and in the manner that it was?
Well, Your Honor, I would use the analogy that I could send a notice letter mimicking the same thing that Mometrix said. That doesn't magically implicate the DMCA. You can say whatever you want. Point is that CreateSpace is more like iTunes than it is like a YouTube or Facebook, because it resells LCR's content.
So yeah, and I noticed that in your briefing, you refer to CreateSpace as your customer.
Correct.
The determination that they are your customer, is that essential to your argument?
That's an argument we're making, and it's twofold, Your Honor. That's because we liken the, yes, it's essential to the argument. Yes, the factual record has more than sufficient evidence to carry that burden with regard to commercial speech exception and with regard to the DMCA.
And so they purchase from you? They're your customer, not somebody who purchases the test materials?
Your Honor, I don't want to misspeak. My understanding is that this is discussed in the Richter Declaration,
right,
attached to the response to the TCPA motion, and I believe it is that CreateSpace pays LCR. If that helps. In other words, the product sells like a reseller would pay a wholesaler. I think that's how the arrangement is, but that's...
Hence your argument that the interference prevented you from fulfilling your contractual obligations with CreateSpace.
Yes, Your Honor.
Gotcha.
And then I want to highlight one other issue with the DMCA. There are other provisions that invoke the DMCA, and one of them is that the ISP does not receive a financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing activity. So if the content provider is receiving money for what Mometrix claims they own, then it's explicitly exempted from the DMCA. That is a long-winded way of saying that the DMCA does not apply in this case, and that anything that Mometrix has done, right or wrong, doesn't transform that. And so there's no preemption on a tortious interference claim, and that's the result. So in Rock River, not only did the Federal District Court for California say that the tortious interference claim is not preempted, they dismissed the DMCA claim that the defendant brought in the first place because it didn't apply. So there's a nuance there. I want to talk a little bit about a procedural issue that the court raised a second ago. Mometrics, at no time at the trial court, raised the argument of preemption. They didn't file a pleaded jurisdiction. They didn't file a 91A motion. And so now, here, for the first time in a reply brief, they've raised the DMCA argument as a preemption argument. And regardless of whether or not subject matter jurisdiction is waivable, the ground for their argument is not, right? So our position is that, okay, you can't just parade this argument in a reply brief at the last minute. And by the way, more importantly, the TCPA, we contend, the TCPA is the wrong vehicle to assert such a jurisdictional challenge. Because if the TCPA does apply, the inquiry is whether or not a party advanced clear and specific evidence of each essential claim. And that's an inquiry that's entirely different from it's different from a jurisdictional inquiry. And there's a citation that was not contained in a brief, State Fair of Texas, Riggs and Riggs, Dallas Court of Appeals, August 2nd, 2016, that touches upon the issue. And they said that they stated that the intended purpose of the TCPA was explicit in section 27005C of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And then it goes on to say that this is an inherently different inquiry than whether the movement presented evidence to show the trial court possessed jurisdiction, which is generally but not always determined by the face of the petition. Finally, Mometrics cannot have it both ways. In the event that this court determines that no jurisdiction exists, the court has one option: dismiss the claims against Mometrics and Mometrics in its entirety, including Mometrics' TCPA motion to dismiss. I will add that Mometrics has asserted a counterclaim, which is somewhat bizarre, but they have asserted a counterclaim to ask the court for a declaration that they are the copyright owner or have the right to enforce the copyright. But it's confusing because in their brief, the position they're taking is that we somehow are raising that issue when in fact they are, notwithstanding, it's the preemption argument is one for all. If tortious interference is claimed, so is their counterclaim. And so the point is that the court wouldn't have jurisdiction to hear this TCPA, and to Mr. Sibley's points, not award mandatory fees against LCR.
As much fun as all the copyright stuff is, you guys have some thorny issues with regard to the TCPA application itself, both the commercial exception and also your prima facie case. Does anybody want to talk about that today, or are we just going to figure it out?
Happy to do it, Your Honor. With regard to, let me take the commercial speech exception and discuss that a little bit. The record supports the fact that Mometrics' actions constituted commercial speech and are therefore exempt from the TCPA. And this conclusion comports with the Texas Supreme Court's recent decision in Castleman, that was April 27, 2018, as well as Geary and I believe it's Estep. And so the one point that I would like to address was, first of all, the trial court got it right. And so the elements of, in the event that the trial court did deny the TCPA because the commercial speech exception was applicable, the only nuance that Castleman clarifies is the third prong of this of the commercial speech exception. And I'm happy to go through the prongs if the court, I'm sure the court knows it better than I do. In Castleman, the issue and the confusion amongst the courts in Texas was whether or not the statement or conduct at issue arose out of a commercial transaction involving the kinds of goods or services that I think it was a person does. And so people said, well, maybe it's plaintiff, maybe it's defendant. Castleman says, no, that relates to the defendants. The statement has to arise out of commercial transactions that the defendants provides. And so...
So is CreateSpace a potential customer of Mometrics?
Oh my gosh, Your Honor, I believe so, but I'll have to check, and I'm happy to submit that in a briefing. I think they are, but I can't make a representation definitively.
That seems to be. I'm sorry.
But you agree that's what Castleman requires, that the defendant it's actually the defendant's potential customer that the statement has to be directed to.
Yes, Your Honor. And let me answer it like this, though. They do sell on Amazon, and anything through CreateSpace goes through Amazon. So the answer is yes, they're competing in the same marketplace for the same vehicle.
But because is Amazon or CreateSpace the actual customer or potential customer, or are they just a platform by which the products ultimately end up being sent to the actual customer?
That's correct, Your Honor. So
it's correct that they're a platform.
That's correct that I don't know if the right word is. So I'll give you an example. I create content. I'm not printing books. I'm doing them on demand. So anytime someone buys it, it's automatically printed by CreateSpace. But a person would go to the retail site on Amazon, select the book, CreateSpace spits it out. And so it kind of works in conjunction. Is that making it any clearer?
I understand the facts. Well, I'm just saying, do you assert that makes CreateSpace and Amazon a customer?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Yes, as we said before, a reseller. And
well, and so your evidence showed that with the Richter Declaration that LCR sells to CreateSpace.
Uh-huh.
And my understanding, Mometrics is a direct competitor of LCR. I mean, is that right? That's your accusation that
that's correct.
Mometrics is actually doing this conduct because they're a direct competitor?
That's correct.
And in that situation, if they're a direct competitor, wouldn't they be a potential customer for CreateSpace?
Wouldn't Mometrics be a potential customer for CreateSpace?
CreateSpace be a potential customer for Mometrics?
That's correct.
Okay. I was helping you answer his question.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm confused. I'm going to fall back on this. This is my first oral argument.
Sure.
So.
And then under Castleman seems to go a couple steps further and talk about that the statement has to be with regard to the defendant's sale of a product. Well, here, Momedia was giving notice that you all's sale of a product somehow, or that y'all's product had some copyright infringement issues. How does that relate to Momedia's sale of a product?
Very good question, Your Honor. In its opening brief, Mometrics acknowledges that, and this is the TCPA motion that was filed at trial court level, Mometrics acknowledges that the letters to CreateSpace were, quote, clearly made to inform Amazon that certain goods and products being offered in the online market space by plaintiff infringed upon Mometrics' intellectual property rights.
Okay, I'm looking in there for something that involves the defendant's sale of goods, which the Supreme Court seems to be telling us.
Understood, Your Honor, and I would submit to the court that the answer lies in Geary, where if arise out of is...
Well, Mr. Saber, does Castleman actually require a sale by the defendant?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Does Castleman actually require a sale by the defendant, or does it have to just be in the context of a potential sale?
I guess... Our position on that, Your Honor, would be if the plaintiff, LCR, is potentially providing goods and services, and the statement related to Mometrics's goods or services, that would meet the third prong of the commercial speech exception.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seemed to me Castleman was not saying that there had to be an actual sale. It doesn't mm-hmm. have to be only in a sales transaction that this statement occurs. It just has to meet the factor that the defendant is talking to or about a potential customer or buyer.
About the defendant's products.
Correct.
And so I'm trying to figure out how this is about the defendant's products. It seems to be about the plaintiff's products.
So, Your Honor, the answer to our position would be that the statement or conduct that Mometrics is saying that, look, LCR's books contain Mometrics, you know, not conceding that it does, but what they said was that LCR's books contain Mometrics' intellectual property as related to or proceed from Mometrics' actual publications. So if, as in Geary, if arose out is construed to mean to result, issue, or proceed, intellectual property is what Mometrics does, or at least that's what they claim to do. I don't know if I answered your question.
I understand the argument. It just seems a little attenuated to me.
I guess I think I'm out of time, and so thank you very much for your time, for the court's time this morning.
Mr. Sibley?
Yes, Your Honor. Very quickly on this Rock River case, the holding actually of that case, as recognized in the Amaretto case, is not. It's not based on whether Apple was a service provider under the DMCA. Actually, in footnote 10, what it says is plaintiff argues that the correspondence is a DMCA takedown notice, but the court concludes that what you sent was not a DMCA notice. It was just a cease and desist letter. So what Rock River says is, if all I do is send a cease and desist letter and it's not a DMCA notice, it doesn't have the elements of a DMCA notice, then it doesn't qualify under the DMCA.
Can we talk just procedurally for a second? I think we were all kind of accepting that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time. But is preemption is it that type of animal that you can raise it whenever you want, or is it truly a defense? In other words, you know, a special appearance is subject matter jurisdiction, but you can waive it. Why can we rule on preemption at the Court of Appeals level?
A special appearance, Your Honor, I think would be personal jurisdiction, which is waivable, but subject matter jurisdiction is not.
Well, special appearance is the vehicle by which you raise personal jurisdiction, right?
Correct.
Which and is you waivable. Have to do it before you answer.
Which is, right, venue, those things, there are certain waivable defenses, but subject matter is not one. So,
but is preemption a defense?
Preemption has been classified as a defense, but it's a non-waivable defense. I mean, subject matter jurisdiction is a...
Is it case law that says that? Or is it just... Is it case law that says preemption is not a waivable defense?
I don't know if there's case law that says preemption is not a waivable defense, but there is case law that says subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable, and the way you raise preemption is through subject matter jurisdiction. So, sort of by implication, I don't think preemption is waivable.
And I may be thinking of this incorrectly, but is personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction not the same thing?
No.
So that's your distinction, is that that's a totally different subject?
Correct.
Okay.
It would be like trying to litigate a patent claim. It's just not waivable. The parties can't consent to it. It can be raised at any time, even on appeal, if never raised in the trial court, even after a trial.
And that's true of preemption?
Yes, because preemption is based on subject matter jurisdiction grounds, which it is here, which is federal. I mean, there are other bases for preemption. For example, administrative preemption. There are some remedies that are only available in the Railroad Commissioner's Court, things like that. Those are not waivable because it's the exclusive jurisdiction of that particular body. But very quickly, Your Honor, I want to talk about this claim that CreateSpace is one of our customers. Clearly, is not in the record. That's a claim that they made. And it's a claim that was only made after we filed the TCPA motion. And if you look at their petition, there is an evolution of what CreateSpace is. In their petition, they claim CreateSpace is Amazon's independent online publisher. And they tell the truth, which is that they're offering their products through Amazon, which is an online marketplace. After we filed the TCPA motion, they realized that, well, we can try to make it commercial speech. So then they come up with this sort of sham declaration which says CreateSpace is our customer.
So you don't have a counterclaim for a declaration?
We did file a counterclaim for a declaration of ownership rights, because that is one of their claims, is that we don't own the copyright. So I do think state courts can adjudicate ownership as to contract rights, but I would agree that after reviewing the case law, even if we didn't have the DMCA, I mean, they're... Part of their claim goes to the construction of the copyright code. They're claiming that they have the rights to one of those pieces because they had a work for hire a year before. I mean, these are all getting into copyright issues, which I think are preempted. But this argument that CreateSpace is not a content provider is also just completely false. There are cases that have construed Section 512. For example, Hendrickson versus eBay, Central District, California, 2001, 165 F sup 2nd 1082. That's eBay. I mean, eBay and Amazon are basically the same thing. You have users who put products online and sell them. And if you look at CreateSpace's terms of service, which is in Reporters Record 5, Exhibit 1, it says you are responsible for your content. I mean, this is a published on-demand service. This is not a customer. They don't buy things. It's not like Barnes & Noble, for example, where they might buy someone's publications and then offer them for sale. This is a user-based, Amazon is a user-based marketplace. You can find 15 different buyers for the same, or excuse me, sellers for the same product on Amazon. So there's no question it's preempted. We're entitled to our attorney's fees. The TCPA applies. The commercial speech exception doesn't apply. We would ask that the court remand to the trial court for further proceedings.
And I have another question. I know you're out of time, but the term of service, is everything that is in the record is kind of cut off and we can't read it in the margins. Is there a better copy anywhere in the record? Or is this the best copy that the court has?
I think that's the copy that was transmitted by the clerk. That was one of the reasons why we had asked for a little more time. And it turns out that that is the copy that the clerk had. I know that there was, I believe, okay. Just the pagination created that. But we also have, that's in the clerk's record. But in the reporter's record, Your Honor, at volume 5, exhibit 1, there was another.
That's the same thing?
It's not the same thing. It's if you look at those terms of service,
yeah.
There are all these hyperlinks. So
right, and they're not the same thing anymore either, I don't think.
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but I do know that that was part of. I mean, that's part of the terms of service of CreateSpace. It talks about. Okay. I mean, it says right at the top here. I'm looking at Exhibit 1.
Yeah.
It says CreateSpace, self-publishing and free distribution for books. I mean, this is not a purchaser of products. It's a publisher. That's what they said in their petition. They changed it to try to get into the commercial speech exception.
Okay. All right.
Any further? Okay, thank you both for an interesting argument. The case will be submitted and parties be dismissed.
All rise.